And the court will proceed to the fifth case, Fierschek versus Holder. Smar?
Good morning, Your Honors. James Maher, M-A-H-E-R. Thank you for hearing me. It's our contention that collateral estoppel, when it's used offensively, is discretionary, and that the immigration judge and the Board of Immigration Appeals abused their discretion when they applied it in this case. The issues, although similar in the denaturalization case, are not identical. In the removal action, the government was required to prove that there were misrepresentations of fact as opposed to omissions of fact. It's our position that that didn't happen and that we should have been given an opportunity to defend on the immigration court level. Similarly to the naturalization trial, no one with personal knowledge testified at the trial, Your Honors, about the naturalization process at all. Edgar Sutter, who was the man who had personal knowledge about how this gentleman became a displaced person, did not testify. No one from the Army Corps of Engineers, who are the people that actually investigated people who were coming into the country as displaced persons, testified at trial. The visa application that the government used to denaturalize my client has no questions whatsoever about where he worked during the war, none at all. And the two gentlemen that testified by way of de bene esse depositions had no personal knowledge at all as to how the man came in the country. So how that can lead the court to conclude that there were material misrepresentations of fact is unclear to me when there's no evidence of that. As I argued before, I respectfully argue again that the burden of proof was ignored. In both cases, the burden of proof is clear and convincing evidence. Government has to prove, meet their burden by clear and convincing evidence. As I argued at trial, the fact that the documents are 20 years old, allegedly, doesn't prove that they're Ukrainian auxiliary police records. You know, respectfully, I could put a date of 1942 on a piece of paper buried in my backyard, and 50 years later someone could dig it up and say, well, this document came from 1942. It's admissible as an ancient document. What is it? There was no evidence that these documents were 20 years old. What happened at trial, which I was present for every day of it, was a routine introduction of evidence, of documents, over and over. Objection, overruled. Objection, overruled. Objection, overruled. Judge, they're not dated. There's no evidence they're over 20 years old. Judge, there's no testimony as to what they are. Overruled. Every single document was introduced in that fashion. And respectfully, to say that just because you're a member of this organization that therefore you misrepresented facts, that's not logical. I see those as two separate issues. If you're a member, you're a member. But whether or not you misrepresented facts in connection with the process by which you obtain your citizenship is a separate, completely separate issue that has to be evaluated separately. That's not what happened in either one of these cases. The judge concluded that, well, if he's a member, then he misrepresented facts. You lose. You're denaturalized. You're deported. Go away. The credibility of the gentleman when he testified isn't relevant to the issue of the documents. That's a totally separate issue as well, Your Honors. The court in the denaturalization felt strongly that my client was not being credible. But that does not substitute for evidence at trial that the documents are, in fact, Ukrainian auxiliary police records. That was the issue that the government had to prove. And their government expert testified for probably a day and a half, and not one question was asked of him. What, in your opinion, is this piece of paper, Dr. Pohl? Well, in my opinion, it's an Ukrainian auxiliary police record. And it seems to me that there's only two types of evidence, documents and witnesses. And if there's no testimony from a witness that this document is what it is, the judge cannot come to that conclusion. The judge is an impartial observer and a listener to evidence. He has to have evidence from their expert as to what these documents are, and that did not happen at this trial. I also respectfully, as a secondary argument, argue that we weren't given a full and fair opportunity at the trial level. Therefore, we shouldn't have had collateral estoppel imposed against us offensively before the immigration court. And the reason why was because The cross-examination was interrupted 19 times. The judge assisted them in introducing exhibits about 10 or 11 times. It actually reminded them to introduce documents and evidence. As I said, there was no evidence that the documents were over 20 years old. All my objections were overruled. Even the ones where the judge said, well, I agree, counsel, you make a good point. This document isn't dated. I'll consider it for what it's worth. Respectfully, that's not the job of a judge to just, I'll accept everything for what it's worth and not rule on your objections. And that was my problem, respectfully. I felt I wasn't heard at the trial and that my arguments weren't heard because I never got anything back from the trial judge as to why my objections are being overruled and why the documents are mechanically being introduced into evidence. Respectfully, I've tried a lot of cases. I've tried 30 cases in 10 years. I respectfully insist that the trial was unfair, and I hope your honors will grant the remedy, which is to send it back to the immigration court for a trial on these issues, which haven't been fairly and fully determined.
Thank you, Mr. Maher.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Mr. Canetti.
Good morning, Your Honors. William H. Kennedy, Office of Special Investigations, United States Department of Justice. There is very little new that is here in this case, and what is new was raised by the appellant for the first time in his reply brief. As Judge Mannion said in Bakarian v. Mukasey, 541 F3rd 775, in order for this court to have jurisdiction over an issue, the petitioner must first exhaust his administrative remedies by raising it before the BIA. There are a number of matters that were raised for the first time in this court, particularly in the appellant's reply brief, that this court should not consider. Even if this court were to consider them, this court should find them meritless. I specifically mentioned what appear to be a plausible argument on its face, and that is appellant's argument that collateral estoppel did not apply because the issues were not the same. Appellant seizes upon this court's decision in Shillong to note a distinction between a concealment and a misrepresentation. Yet, however, in both the district court proceedings and in the proceedings before this panel, both decisions rested on a misrepresentation. Shillong said if a concealment was found in the denaturalization, you need to prove a misrepresentation in the removal. It's not the same thing. It's true. But a misrepresentation is the word that the district court judge used constantly in deciding the case, and it's the word that this court used in affirming the case. Appellant raises several other issues during his oral argument. Those issues, for example, are, were the documents identified as Ukrainian auxiliary police documents? And he is correct that the government's expert at trial, Dr. Dieter Pohl, did not say this is a Ukrainian police record. And I simply give as one example, Exhibit 93, where the colloquy between prosecutor and witness is, are you familiar with this document? Yes, it came from the Lviv Regional State Archives. You have any reason to question its authenticity, and so forth. And it's true. The prosecutor didn't say, is this a Ukrainian auxiliary police document? Yet, if one were to look at Exhibit 93 and many of the other exhibits, it says right on the heading, First Commissariat of the Ukrainian Police. Furthermore, it's dated Lviv, 10 August 1942, and it goes on to state that the appellant, Osip Fereshak, did certain actions on this day. Appellant's counsel also frequently mentioned the fact that the district court judge interfered with cross-examination and the like. And I'll give the court two brief examples. These appear in an appendix to the government's brief. Defense counsel says, were any individuals, to your knowledge, affiliated with the Ukrainian police, prosecuted or tried as war criminals at that time? Government counsel objects and says, could we have clarification of at that time? and the court says you should specify the period. Defense counsel says, I thought I did, 1949, but I'll do it again. I apologize. We're now talking about the time period when the war ended, 1949. The witness says, 1945. And the court says, May 8, 1945. The witness said, defense counsel says, sorry, that was when the war ended. Witness says, in Europe. An even briefer example is defense counsel says, and that document does not name the Osip Vereshchak, who is the defendant in this case, as anyone who discharged cartridge at that time. And the court interjects. In other words, the question is the defendant mentioned in that document? And the witness says no. There are numerous instances where there were interruptions, in part because the government counsel interrupted with an objection, such as asking for a date, or where the court interrupted to make a clarification. These do not indicate that District Judge Deryagin was biased or that the appellant did not get a fair trial. There has been much said in the briefs about the supposed unfairness of the trial, particularly that Judge Deryagin was not randomly selected. Appellant admits in his opening brief, page 19, that appellant is not entitled, as a matter of law, to a randomly selected judge. And then he admits in his reply brief at what I've now numbered as page 23, starting from the start of the argument, that there is no evidence to indicate the trial judge was not randomly selected. And there's also an argument that has been raised in the briefs that the evidence was legally insufficient. There were 21 wartime documents containing the name of Osip Vereshchak, establishing that he served in the Ukrainian Auxiliary Police. Many of these documents have not only his name, but biographical data, such as his date of birth, his place of birth, and his father's name. Seven of those documents have his signature, and the defendant's reply brief concedes at page 17 that the signatures are that of the appellant. There is ample basis for finding that he did what he did. We know that the petitioner served in the Ukrainian police from almost the beginning of the Nazi occupation of Lviv. We know that during the Nazi occupation of Lviv, the Ukrainian police was widely, repeatedly, and consistently used in persecutory activities against Jews, in roundups against Jews, incarcerations against Jews, and we know that ultimately approximately 100,000 men, women, and children of the Jewish faith were murdered simply because they were Jews. I ask this court to affirm the decision below.
Thank you, Andy.
Thank you, Your Honor. So, brief rebuttal. I can't stand before you and say I know for a fact what happened, and I don't think the government should say either. What happened is for the court to determine from the witnesses who testified and not from the lawyers who were arguing. I appreciate their admission, finally, that there was no evidence at this trial that any document was, in fact, an authentic Ukrainian auxiliary police record. That's the first time I've ever heard that, and I appreciate that because that's the truth. This witness did not testify that any document was authentic. His name could appear on 3,000 documents, Your Honor, without testimony as to what the document is. The implication that, in fact, he was a member cannot be proven. It's like going to a medical malpractice case and calling your expert witness and failing to ask them whether or not the duty of care was breached to the patient. If you don't ask the expert, the opinion doesn't get any evidence, and the fact finder cannot conclude that any one of those documents is, in fact, a Ukrainian auxiliary police record. That's why this matter must be reversed. I also respectfully appreciate that he's agreeing that the issues were not identical. That's also the first time I've ever heard that from the government, that the issues in the immigration case are not the same as the denaturalization case. Proof was required that he actually misrepresented facts in order to deport someone under the Holtzman Amendment. And as I said before, there was no evidence at this trial that he misrepresented anything. We don't know that because no one with personal knowledge testified to that at the trial. These gentlemen did not remember. They didn't remember anything about Osip Vereshchak, naturally, because 50 years had passed, so I'm not saying that's surprising, and the man who could have testified was Edgar Sutter. He did not testify. Without evidence from the fact finder to jump to the conclusion that someone misrepresented things. You can't assume that that's what happened, even if you find that he's a member. Those are two separate issues. Whether he's a member and whether he misrepresented facts are two separate issues. As to random selection, I cannot prove that this matter was not steered to Judge Duryagin. I asked in the pleadings for something from the government. Only they know whether or not they steered this to Judge Duryagin by sending a copy of the complaint to someone else other than the clerk initially. And I have no answer. I still have no answer. And all I know is I conducted the trial, and I respectfully suggest that that trial was unfair from start to finish. And there's many examples of that. They're in the brief, and I ask your honors to consider that. Thank you for hearing me.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. The case is taken under advisement. The court will